Hi, this is Padma Lakshmi, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. You're the bomb.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, the number one female-focused food podcast in the universe. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Let's thank today's sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Schools, who I'm actually hanging out with this week in London. Be sure to check out the Cherry Bomb Instagram account to see what I'm up to. And we are so excited to welcome back one of our sponsors, Emmy, the makers of beautiful cheeses from Switzerland, including my personal favorite, the Emmy Cave-Aged Kaltbach Le Gruyere AOP. We have a few announcements to make. Attention bakers and makers, our friends at Ovenly are holding a holiday pop-up shop competition for women-led startups to take over their Studio 154 in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Ovenly will choose two winners who will create their very own holiday pop-up shop and receive business advice from Ovenly's award-winning leaders. That would be CEO Aaron Patinkin and COO Agatha Kulaga. Visit the Ovenly website for more information about how you can enter the competition. And hey, if you win, we'll help promote your pop-up on the Cherry Bomb Instagram account. Thank you to everyone who came to our Food for Thought event in Columbus, Ohio last week at the HQ of Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams. I love everything Jenny's, so it was a treat to hang out there. We'll be airing the Food for Thought episodes in the weeks ahead, so stay tuned. And thank you to Kerrygold, the makers of beautiful Irish cheese and butter, for supporting our tour. The next stop is Houston, Texas, on October 7th at Nancy's Hustle. You can hustle on over to cherrybomb.com to snag a ticket. Our Seattle Jubilee tickets are also on sale for November 2nd at Block 41. We have a great day planned for you with our favorite folks, including Allison Roman, Aaron Goyawaga, Renee Erickson, Makini Howell, Rachel Yang, and others. If you live on the West Coast and haven't experienced Jubilee yet, join us. Next up is another way to experience Jubilee. Today's episode happens to be from Jubilee 2019 in New York City. Laura Brown, the effervescent editor-in-chief of InStyle magazine, sat down with the queen of pasta, Chef Missy Robbins of Lilia and Missy Restaurants. Their talk is both funny and poignant, so be sure to stay tuned. Introducing Laura and Missy is Bomb Squad favorite, Martha Hoover of the Patachou Restaurant Group in Indianapolis. Before we hear from these movers, shakers, and pasta lovers, let's hear a word from Emmy. Hey, Bomb Squad, let's talk about Emmy cheese from Switzerland. Emmy's beautiful variety of cheeses are crafted from the freshest milk from local Swiss farms. One of our favorites is Emmy Le Gruyere AOP. With notes of candied walnuts, spice, and dried fruit, Emmy's Le Gruyere AOP is perfect for snacking. And if you want to get more creative, you can do what Chef Elizabeth Faulkner does and make an apple and Le Gruyere crumble. This perfect fall recipe is fragrant with nutmeg and cinnamon, and the apple and Gruyere are perfect companions. Make it next level by melting some Emmy raclette on top. Looking for something more savory? How about this special recipe from Chef Elizabeth? French onion soup pizza with Emmy Gruyere AOP, fresh thyme, and mushrooms. You can find these recipes and more at emmyusa.com, and you can find Emmy's delicious cheeses from Switzerland, the ones with the distinctive blue and red logo, at your favorite grocery store or cheesemonger. Let's welcome Martha Hoover.
The company I founded in 1989, I started having never worked in a restaurant and not knowing I was pregnant with my third child. If I could do it then and there, all of us can be doing it now. Patachou is proof that you can build an inclusive, positive, value-based business culture without sacrificing profitability. And it's also proof that an organization can grow and prosper without the exploitation of the people who make its success possible. And I will always maintain that it is easier to build inclusive cultures than it is to try to correct ones that are inherently and insidiously flawed. Well, thank you. I've been invited here to introduce two remarkable women. First, Missy Robbins and Laura Brown, soon to come up on stage. And I'm just going to say this, I'm going to throw this out there. Missy Robbins is kind of like the Missy Elliott of the food world. And it's not just because their first names are the same. Missy Elliott, rapper, singer, producer, Grammy Award winner. To this day, she is the best-selling female rapper in music history, and her experimental video concepts changed the landscape of hip-hop forever. Her music includes themes of feminism, gender equality, body positivity, sex positivity, and she cleared the path for and supported other women in her industry. My God, Missy Elliott even released an album called Cookbook. She should be here right now. And then she went ahead and performed at the Super Bowl, but only after taking a significant time away to reflect, get healthy, achieve work-life balance, and to figure out how to create healthy work environments in an industry known for misogyny, homophobia, gender inequality, along with the easy stuff like grueling hours and unrelenting expectations. Does that sound like any industry you guys know about? I don't know. So what about our Missy, Food Missy? Well, Missy Robbins has led two restaurants to Michelin star status before opening her own restaurant, Lilia, in Williamsburg. Lilia earned 3 stars from the New York Times and a James Beard nomination. Missy was named Best Chef by Food & Wine, and in 2018, Robbins was recognized as the Best Chef New York City by the James Beard Foundation, and just last year, she opened up her second restaurant, Missy, also located here in Brooklyn. You know, being a chef requires more than aptitude and zeal. Cooking is as much a trade as it is an art, and owning and operating restaurants is as much science as it is magic. And as much as we glorify the jobs and the industry, chefs and owners know that they must mundanely negotiate with vendors, run inventory, train staff, maintain safety protocols, work in helter-skelter environments, and occasionally compromise their standards to deal with restive customers and demanding investors. Every chef with the Michelin star and James Beard Award has suffered mind-numbing labor, cuts, and burns. And that is the reality of the industry in which we live. So while on this upward trajectory through the ranks of chefdom, racking up accolades and awards, our Missy, Missy Robbins, decided to leave the grueling world of restaurants and cooking because it took a toll. It took a toll in terms of sacrifices of time, health, and relationships. So in 2013, she hung up the title of executive chef, and she left to explore life outside of restaurants. And much like Music Missy, she came back to her industry stronger than ever. She took her significant time off to self-reflect and to produce this fabulous work. It's fabulous and very personal work, I should say. Her cookbook, Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and Life. And also, she came back with a new perspective on how to foster personal health and happiness while taking care of the needs of everybody else. Laura Brown is the award-winning editor-in-chief of InStyle magazine. Truthfully, she caught my attention many years ago with an article entitled The Simpsons Go to Paris. It was pretty brilliant. It still makes me laugh, and I laughed a lot when I heard that I was introducing her, because that article was ripped out and is in my file on my desk. She's basically the executive chef of a publishing brand where she oversees print and digital platforms of 13 international editions of InStyle magazine, a fashion and beauty magazine for the modern woman. Laura Brown has breathed life back into the print magazines and brought fun back to fashion and lifestyle reporting. I follow her on Instagram, where she is really hilarious, pretending like she fainted when she met Gloria Steinem not so long ago. She also tackles difficult issues such as immigration reform in her magazine. She does it with humor, grace, and gusto. And meaningful to me, and having nothing to do with food, I'm an animal lover. I'm someone who has lived with, and still do, cats, dogs, goats, horses, and chickens. And perhaps this is because Laura's the daughter of an Australian dairy farmer, InStyle, under her leadership, became the first major magazine to ban photography of and advertisements for fur. So I am honored to introduce to you two women who are continually disrupting industry norms while pushing their own organizations forward, Missy Robbins and Laura Brown.
Firstly, Missy and I are in agreement that compared to Martha's achievements, we're both going to hell.
I think Martha should just stay up here and talk for the next 30
bye.
Minutes.
Oh, except you have a James Beard Award, but you do not have a Jane's Beard Award. So
those are next.
You know, dream big, sister. So Missy and I actually met 5 years ago. Missy was consulting to a restaurant in Chelsea Market, and I went with a friend of mine, and Missy was there, and we ate some pasta, and I was like, "What is this? What is this magical bowl?" And I had a few wines, breaking news, and I just became completely possessed with this pasta and this groovy lady who was there talking to us and feeding us dinner. And not only was the food delicious, but there was an ease to her, there was a naturalness to her, there was just a way of being that you were doing what you were supposed to do. And after about my third wine, I said, Missy was saying she wanted to open a restaurant. And I said, ha-ha, I'll give you $50 and I'll be your first investor. I put it in a tip envelope, gave it to Missy, and so frankly, I think the room, all the room knows this, that I made you.
Very true story. I still have the envelope.
Is the cash still in there?
Cash is still in there. At home.
Can I have it? No.
I meant to bring it to you today.
But this is how compelling. Immediately, I was like, I know you know what you're doing. I know you're going to do great things. And like, you know, I don't, yeah.
The weird thing about the story is there was no pasta on the menu at that restaurant. I was bored that night and just like, I'm going to make you pasta because I feel like it.
Yeah, well, thanks.
Foreshadowing to the
and
future.
And foreshadowing.
Yes.
So breaking news. Oh, this is Missy's T-shirts. I'm sure if you've seen this, if you haven't worn one, you really must. This is... We have the T-shirts that go with Missy, with Lilia and Missy, the new restaurant. So I wear it with pride, and I will choose pasta if I'm ever on death row. Anyway, so Missy, the question is though, when did you first
choose pasta?
Yep.
You know, it's funny. I went about 15, the first 10 years of my career with kind of doing what we called back in the 90s new American food.
Right.
And I was cooking with influences from everywhere, but I had grown up in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm not Italian. I'm just a Jewish girl from Connecticut, Eastern European. But New Haven has this amazing Italian American community, and I grew up eating red sauce Italian, baked ziti, fettuccine Alfredo, pizza, all this stuff, and I was always sort of fascinated, and my mom thought she was European, and we would never go to like normal supermarkets. We would go to like the fish market and the kosher butcher and the Italian market to get olive oil and cheese. And I just grew up in this way that I was very focused on ingredients. So when I started cooking, that kind of thing always really resonated with me. Whenever the deliveries came in and there was a new olive oil or there was a porcini mushroom, I always really gravitated towards that. And when I was 28, I was cooking and I had this very intense job and I wanted to go to Europe because I thought I was going to be an adult soon, and if I didn't go like live above a restaurant in Europe then I might not ever do it.
You expire.
Dreams, I mean real dreams. And so I left and I went to Italy and I stayed there for 6 months and really absorbed.
You speak Italian?
I mean, speak is a relative term. I can make it through a train station, a restaurant, a wine list, and a menu.
All
and a hotel.
Need.
That's all you need in
all
life,
need.
Right?
Yeah.
And I went there for 6 months, and I sort of learned that Italy had so much beyond red sauce Italian, and that there were really these 20 cuisines in Italy, and kind of fell in love with it. But when I came back to the States 6 months later, I still didn't want to be pigeonholed into this cuisine. And I went and worked at a hotel and did something completely different than I had been doing. And then 3.5 years later, I got this call from Chicago to go work in this little restaurant called Spiaggia that was a 4-star fine dining, beautiful restaurant. And I got the call to go be the chef de cuisine there. And I was sort of ready for a change. I was thinking about moving to Brooklyn. That was going to be my big change from Manhattan.
That's radical.
We can get to that later. And there was this just really amazing connection between myself and Tony Montuano, who is the chef partner of Spiaggia Still, from the very first phone call. And I got off that call with him, and I flew out there, and I did a tasting for him, and I moved 5 weeks later and stayed there for 5 years. And Italy just, I like to say I have an Italian soul. It just became a part of me, and I kind of stopped focusing on all these other global cuisines and really honed in on honing this one skill of making pasta and learning Italian culture.
What would you regard as your first, like, professional success? I mean, you have official grades of the Michelin stars and great restaurants you've worked at, but what was it, perfectly constructing a dish? Was it somebody saying it was delicious? Was it acknowledgement in the press? Was it, what was your first?
No, I think there are a couple of moments throughout your career and your definition of success changes. And so I think getting that job at Spiaggia was a really significant moment of me taking this fine dining world that I had grown up with in my 20s and kind of moving away from that to go do this hip hotel in downtown Manhattan and really not feeling like I fit in that world, and then getting this giant job to go back to four-star dining. But I think the accolades and the awards and all that stuff is really lovely, but it's not how I define success. I think it's more about finding happiness in what you do every day. And as we all know, this environment that we work in can be grueling. It's long hours, you don't have weekends, you miss out a lot of holidays, you miss out a lot of family things, you miss out on a lot of kind of normal life. And for me, I think right now is where I feel most successful. And it's not because of getting 3 stars in the New York Times, it's because I love going to work every day. And I have these 2 restaurants now that I'm really proud of, and where people and the public really love it, but also we have these teams who really enjoy working for us. And that to me is really what I thrive off of now, is kind of building these teams and seeing where they get to go in their career and how far we can help them get there.
And after you left, you were at Avoce for how long?
I was at Avoce for 5 years.
5 years, just earning a casual Michelin star? Were you casual when you earned it?
Yeah. You know, that was an interesting situation because I initially, when I got offered that job, that was one of the exciting parts of the job to me. This company that owned Avoce is European, and they're from London, and they were obsessed with Michelin stars, and that was their mission. And I had grown up in this world where Michelin stars didn't exist when I started cooking, but they existed in Europe. And I grew up in a family where my parents took me to Michelin star restaurants when I was very young. And when I was 12 years old, I ate, and I was lucky. And my parents were really into food, and that's why, I mean, I credit my father 100% for me being in this business, whether he likes it or not. But I mean, there was such a culture of dining out in my family, and part of that was going to Michelin star restaurants. And I was like, wow, I'm going to get to work in a place where that's their mission, and they want a Michelin star. And then that sort of became the bane of my existence, actually, because I think when you're cooking for Michelin stars, and when you're focused on that, you stop focusing on what's really important. You stop focusing on cooking from your heart, and you start cooking from, like, is an inspector gonna like this? Is my boss gonna like this? Is this Michelin worthy? And I loved the food I was cooking at Avoce because it's what I knew at the time, but I don't think it was really who I really was.
Right. And then you left.
Then I left.
You just were like, peace. Did you do that? Did you get peace?
No, it wasn't quite that simple.
Yeah, I bet.
It was a very calculated decision, and it was a very hard decision. I think it's very easy to look at it and be like, oh, Missy gave up her job and left. And it was a really hard, hard decision, and a scary decision, because I not only made the decision to leave a pretty incredible job where I was really thriving, but I made a decision to leave and not work and to take time for myself, which I was 20 years into cooking and had never done that before and didn't really know what life outside a restaurant was. So it wasn't easy, but it was definitely the right decision, and a decision I'm really proud of and happy I made, because it changed who I am and as a just an individual, but also as a chef and a leader and a boss and a restaurant owner.
Yeah, I think one of the things I really appreciate about Missy is she's very straightforward. No, but you had a couple years off. In the time off, a relative turn, you were plotting and planning and sleeping, hopefully. But you were also diagnosed with breast cancer. It was right smack in the middle of that, right?
I was diagnosed with breast cancer, actually.
At Oche?
Lilia.
At Lilia, when you opened it up.
What are we in, 2019? I was diagnosed in July of 2017.
So when that happened, what did you do?
Well, what did I do? You know, I mean, I remember the moment very exactly. I had obviously been for biopsies and mammograms, and there was something wrong, and everyone says, you're going to be fine, you're going to be fine, there's nothing wrong with you. And I got a phone call at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. I was sitting in the back room of Lilia quietly working, and they told me it was going to take 2 weeks for them to get back to me, and it took 2 days for them to get back to me. Right. And it was my gynecologist calling, and she had been really amazing through the process. And she picked up the phone, and she said, do you have a minute to talk? And I was like, oh,
yeah.
Like, you don't call someone at Friday at 4 o'clock
or
on
chat.
A summer Friday, by the way, July 14th. And so it was pouring rain out, and I didn't have anywhere, there's nowhere private at Lilia. I don't know if any of you have ever been there, but we built a restaurant with zero privacy. There's no door on the office. There's nowhere to go. And usually I would just walk around the building for important phone calls, but it was raining out. So my business partner, Sean, happened to live a block away at the time, and I knew he wasn't there. And his doorman knew me. So I went to the lobby and whatever, and I talked to the doctor, and she said, I'm going to walk you through this. I'm going to get you into a surgeon. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And it's, you know, it's a really scary moment. And I think you and I talked a little bit about this before, that you hear those four or five words, I'm sorry, but it's cancer. And you think immediately, like, holy shit, like you're going to get chemotherapy the next day.
Yeah.
And I think there's this perception from TV and movies, and if you've never gone through it with a family member or a friend, that you don't really know the process. And I really had to learn that process. But look, I went home, and I at the time was single, and it was very scary. And I talked to my parents, and I talked to my business partner, and I thought it would be a good idea to go to work that night and kind of see
was
how.
That?
And I lasted till like 8, and then I was like, you know, I think I got to go home.
Yeah.
And I had like a good, probably the best cry of my life on that was a Friday on Saturday morning, and then I got up and I was like, you know what, I'm gonna go run. Not a runner. I'm a terrible runner.
3 blocks later, I went.
Anyone who knows me. I got up and I was like, you know what, fuck it, I'm gonna go running. And I.
That's so cinematic.
My girlfriend is laughing at me because she knows that I don't know how to run. I ran to Greenpoint and back from my South Williamsburg apartment, and I felt great, and I made a couple phone calls to talk to some good friends, and I just tried to figure out, you know, how to handle it calmly. And And I was lucky. I had an amazing family. And my mom, who's pretty emotional and a crybaby, I didn't see her cry once through this entire, and I know she cried because my cousin told me that she had a few nightmares.
Cousins always do.
But my parents were like rocks.
Right.
My business partner, Sean, was really amazing during that time, and just wanted to make me feel comfortable. My team was amazing, and they allowed me the space and the time I needed. And I went to work when I could go to work, and I didn't go to work when I couldn't go to work. But it's obviously super scary. But I also luckily had, as breast cancer goes, probably the best case scenario. I did not have to have a mastectomy. No one even mentioned the word to me, and I had radiation, but I did not have chemotherapy, and that made a big difference. But you know, they told me at week 3 that I would become very fatigued from radiation, and I was like, no, I won't. I'm like, I work 14 hours a day, I'm fine. And they're like, no, you're gonna become fatigued. And I said, no, I'm fine. Day 14.
And low.
Day 14, I basically fell asleep on the line at Lilia. And but you know, the thing about having cancer, and this is the second time I've ever talked about it publicly, and I don't mind talking about it, and I think it definitely hasn't changed my life, but it definitely gave me perspective on life. It made me refocus. I was falling into kind of some old patterns that I had of being a workaholic and staying at Lilia too late at night, and It forced me to work less, so I didn't really have a choice. But it also, after treatment was done, I was like, you know what? This is how it's supposed to be. I'm not supposed to work this much. I'm supposed to be taking better care of myself. And mentally, it made me really patient. You go to radiation every day, and sometimes the machine's broken, and they say, go have lunch. And you're like, what? And and you're far from home, and you're not in Williamsburg, where I live. And I would go have lunch, and I would take those moments to myself, and I would actually kind of enjoy them. And I would go take these long walks after radiation, and you become friendly with the people who are treating you every day. And there's also just a perspective that you see women getting treatment that have much worse case scenarios than you. And so I think patience was a big one that came out of that. And
pragmatism.
Also, yeah, and I think also just really kind of understanding that you can't control everything, and focus on the things you can control, and the things you can't control, they're gonna go the way they're gonna go.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. Back to Laura and Missy from Jubilee.
When you envisioned Lilia, was it a building you envisioned? Was it a dish you envisioned? What was in your, like, I don't know, what's your dream board or whatever?
At the time that I envisioned, at the time, anyone who knows me knows I'm not having dream boards at home.
Yeah. But is that what they're called? I don't have one.
My dream board, my little vision board that I was cutting things out of InStyle, Laura.
You're welcome.
Yeah. That looks good. I think Laura picked that one. You know what's crazy? I at the time that Lilia came about, I had been out of work for a year and a half almost before we decided to take the space in Williamsburg. And I had, you know, going back to that theme of success, I had this one vision of success, and that one vision was opening in Lower Manhattan. And that was the only thing that was going to make me feel good.
Right.
And when my partner came to me and said, I have the space in Williamsburg that you should go look at, I said, I'm not fucking opening a restaurant in Williamsburg. Like, I've worked my whole life to open in the West Village, and I'm 43 years old, and that's all I want to do. And it was a really dumb, silly, narrow vision. But I was desperate to go back to work, and while consulting was lovely and fun, and I got to just sit and drink wine with you in the middle of my job, it wasn't going to sustain me long term. And Lilia sort of evolved out of the space. It's in an old auto body shop, and I knew that I could put in a wood-burning grill, and I had changed my diet significantly, and I'd lost 40 pounds, and I changed the way I ate. And ironically, pasta was not meant to be the main feature of Lilia. Fish and vegetables were really meant to be what was highlighted there, and they still are. And pasta sort of just, people latched on to the fact that they thought I could make pasta, which is really nice, and allowed me to be able to open Missy that solely focuses on pasta. But the vision really came out of just years of cooking and a place and time in my life where I really wanted to strip away kind of the Michelin stuff and strip away pretension and just cook the food that I was cooking at home at like a little higher level. And I had cooked at home for the first time in my life.
Right.
During that time that I wasn't working, and it felt really good. And I obviously didn't want to cook the way I was cooking at home exactly, because that was usually in 20 to 30 minutes, but I wanted to take that and be able to bring it to a restaurant level.
And also, how important, style, it's the only thing I understand, so how important is that to you? Because one of the things I love about you is she was a jazzy jumpsuit wearer. Most importantly, wears this daily, correct?
Yeah.
But also, like, super practical unless until you have to go to the loo. But apart from that, great.
Oh, I have a system, Laura.
How important is style to you? Because you pay as much attention to your logo, to your menus, to the aesthetic of your restaurant. Like, how informed are you by that? And how do you inject?
The fashion, what I'm wearing on my body style, it's important, but I don't know anything about it. And I luckily have people in my life who have been very influential in convincing me to change the way I have dressed in the last year. So it feels good. Like, I don't know, I never thought I could pull off a jumpsuit.
I did.
Thank you.
I've always believed
in you. Why didn't
you
tell me 3 years ago when we were when you gave me $50? That doesn't buy a jumpsuit.
It buys a dream.
I never thought I'd be a person who had like a thing, and you know, now people come to Missy and Lily and they like put their jumpsuits on because they
like, do?
Yes.
It's a cult?
Yes, it's a cult. So the jumpsuit's a thing, but outside of fashion, and I hope that I continue on this fashion thing, and I'll never be able to make decisions on my own, but with the help of other people, it feels good to like feel good in your clothing. So
yeah.
As I'm sure you know, but
yeah,
the style thing in terms of design and menu and designing, you know, helping to custom design plates for both restaurants and picking out glassware and working on all the graphic design and working very, very strongly with architects and designers to design both restaurants. That is what I thrive off of now. The food to me is the easy part. And I love it, and I know how to write a menu, I think, after 25 years of doing this. But all of that other stuff and the design stuff is the stuff I've wanted to do and why I wanted to open restaurants for all these years, because I love all of it, and I think all of it is equally as important to the food and beverage, the vibe, the music, which also I know nothing about music, but luckily have great people.
Well, someone there does.
Someone does, and it's not me. But you're learning that I'm not that cool, Laura. Have I shattered your dreams?
It's 15 more minutes on the clock. Anyone want to take my chair? But what you find yourself now, I mean, you are in demand. And I like to say to my team, business is like dating. If you don't keep calling, and if you have a bad time, don't go back. Mm-hmm. But in your case, you are now offered lots of things, including Missy was offered a restaurant in Hudson Yards and said no. How do you calibrate those asks? What do you say yes to? What do you say no to? Or where does your gut take you?
You know, I think it's weird because my life has changed a lot in the last couple of years of since opening Lilia, and now even since opening Missy and since winning a James Beard Award, and it seems to, you know, get more and more intense kind of as the months go by.
She's on GMA with Queer Eye, just by the way.
I was. Laura's very upset that she missed it.
Yep.
We weren't like invited as a group. They just
They'll learn next time.
They happen to be there, and yeah. I happen to be there. I taught them how to make pasta.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think what I try and do is just stay true to who I want to be. And you know, when Hudson Yards is a lovely example, there's 30 examples like that. I think it's important to realize who you want to be and what you want to be and where you want to go to work every day and how you want to work every day. And I think at the time that, you know, Hudson Yards or any big development or whatever has come about, I've stood in the center of Lilia and I've been so excited to be a part of that community that I said I didn't want to go to and now I live in and have two restaurants in. And that's become a real part of our mission, is how do we fit into whatever community that we choose to go, and that community has to feel right, and it has to feel right to Sean and to me, and I just have to really want to do it. And time is so precious to me now, and it's really hard to run two restaurants and have a social life and be with your family and just have downtime, that I saying no has become pretty easy to me.
And you have to learn it, though.
You have to learn it, and I think it is a learned skill, and I find myself going through waves of not being great at it, you know, just in terms of saying yes to too many whatever, dinners outside of Lily and Missy or charity events or whatever it is. And I think you want to satisfy so many people and you don't want to let people down. Forget about the restaurant thing, because those are big decisions of like, do I want to go back into Manhattan or don't I? Or
yes,
do I want to open
you
a
really
third
want
restaurant?
To.
Those are sometimes.
Can you hurry up?
Sometimes
Thank
I
you.
Do. Find a space.
I live on the Upper West Side. Go on.
But Upper West Side. I mean,
know,
listen, never say never. I said never to Williamsburg, and here I am. So I don't know what the future brings for that, but I think saying no is more about sort of protecting your time. And I want to be in my restaurants. That's the other thing. Like, I think part of what has made both restaurants successful so far is that I have been present. And, you know, especially with Lilia, for the first, you know, 2 years, I was there five nights a week, six nights a week, and I think that helped mold my staff, and it helped, like, engage with our guests, and I think people really enjoyed that. And so I don't want to be there six nights a week by any means, but I do want to be engaged in the restaurant. And the more you say yes to, and the more you just are off doing events and flying all over the place, it becomes really difficult. So those things now have to be meaningful to me in order to say yes, whether it's the right charity or the right event or the right speaking engagement, whatever it is, it has to be something that I feel is gonna be meaningful to me.
Touche. I loathe female chef questions, so do you. I loathe female anything questions.
I didn't hear you.
Exactly, but this is one question that I wanna ask that actually Carrie Diamond. I don't even know that the world's 50 best restaurants has a list.
Yeah.
And the world's 50 best gives out a best female chef award that women dislike, but none have turned it down. What would you do if somebody tried to offer that to you?
That is not the question you told me you were going to ask.
Yes. I did so.
You said something totally different yesterday.
You said it shouldn't exist or something, didn't you?
I said, I don't.
Which I agree.
My mother taught me to be polite, so yes. I don't think you ever give back an award if someone gives it to you. I think you accept it politely.
Image.
I think you accept it politely, but I think, I do think that I wish there was just an award for the best chef, and that it wasn't a female chef or a male chef or...
I think we concur. To the point, I wanted to ask, I love to ask people about this often, and it's ambition. And I think that I did an interview with a bunch of women the other day, and they all had very different ideas of, like, I love ambition. Ooh, it sounds mercenary. Ooh, it sounds ego. Oh, it's whatever. What's your position on ambition, and how has your ambition changed?
Oh, God, it's changed so much. I mean, I've always been really ambitious. I wanted to go, since the time I was 12 years old, I picked out a private school in Connecticut that I wanted to go to. My parents said, we don't think you should go to that one. You're going to struggle. And and I said, no, that's the one I'm going to, because I wanted to be challenged. And then for college, I only wanted to go to Georgetown. My father had gone there, and my brother went there, and I couldn't get in. And so I went to another school my freshman year, and I got in my sophomore year. And I've always set these, like, extremely high goals for myself. When I started cooking, I was 22 years old. I said, I'm going to open a restaurant when I'm 30. I don't know where I got that number from. I just made it up, and I said, that's what I'm going to do. I didn't open my first restaurant until I was 44 years old. I was 14 years late on my ambition. So I think your ambition changes, and I think now ambition to me is certainly I want to have professional success, but I think it's equally as important to have success in as a complete human and have a life outside of the restaurants and you know, concentrate on family and relationships and friendships and other things. And I think that's really, I think when you have a singular focus on only doing well in your career and those sort of very tangible things of whether it's getting an award or opening a seventh restaurant or whatever it is, I think that's not so gratifying to me anymore without the other part. So I think you have to be open to sort of ambition changing. And I think that time off that I took for 2 years really helped to form that opinion. And I really learned what life could be like if I had more balance. And to me, that's sort of what it's all about now. And sometimes that's great, and sometimes it's not. It's very easy to hide at a restaurant. I went out last night on a Saturday night, which is rare for me.
Ooh.
And yes.
Go on.
Very exciting. And it's scary how many people are out. And I'm
there they are.
And I'm
they
like
have homes.
And I'm like, there's a reason why I hide inside of my restaurant on Saturday nights. And I'm okay with that. So sometimes like life outside, I think people in this industry feel this certain sense of comfort inside of their little home, whether mm-hmm. it's a bar or restaurant or whatever. And when you send us out into the world, we don't know how to act or behave. And
you're doing great, sweetie.
Thank you. Yeah. And so to me, yeah, I've had to learn how to kind of like balance real world with restaurant world.
How often do you go to eat at other restaurants?
A few times a week. I try. I go to the same five places. Anyone who knows me, you can give my list.
Are there, and so what chefs, I mean, just for a very layman question, but what chefs do you admire, or what chefs are you watching right now?
Oh, wow, that's a big one.
Throw a couple out.
I mean, Nancy Silverton in L.A. is really, wow, everyone likes
her. Yeah, Nancy!
I think...
She said this.
I think I had the best meal that I've had in 2000, I think I was there 2000 in... What are we in? 2018, I think I was in. Mm-hmm. But at Keys Baca was probably my best meal. The guys at Wild Air, I'm loving what they're doing right now. And like, I want to go back and I keep thinking about it. Uncle Boone's, I'm just fascinated by what they do. Right. Yeah.
How often do you eat pasta now? I mean, you're doing another cookbook.
I eat it every day.
Yeah, but you taste it. But like,
I very rarely eat a bowl of pasta.
Yeah.
It is very rare. Not because I don't want to eat it. I still crave pasta every day. It's just more of a health thing than anything. And it's just a control thing. And if I were to eat, I worked really hard to lose that weight a few years ago. And if I were to eat pasta the way I used to eat pasta, I just wouldn't be healthy.
You'd blossom.
So I think I do eat it every day, and I walk down the line of both restaurants, and I taste a lot of pasta, but I just don't eat it like that anymore.
Like that.
Yeah, like...
You want to eat it like that.
I do want to, yeah.
Also, I just think, because a lot of women in the industry here, and you're working in this close quarters with other people, and whether you are the chef, whether you are, you know, cooking pasta or everything else, what did... You learn about management, your management style. How did you cultivate a management style?
Oh, wow. That's developed over many years. And I think, you know, I was a tough manager in my 30s, let's say. And I was in very high-pressure environments, and I didn't always know how to manage and how to listen, which I think is a really important skill as a manager, is how to listen to the people who are talking to you. And I still can be better at it, but I wasn't very good at it, and I knew I wanted to be better, and I got agitated easily, and I think sometimes you work in environments where you don't feel you have the support at the top, and then that can trickle down to you, and then that can trickle down to the people working with you. And I made a commitment to myself and to my partner, and that I wanted to be better when we opened Lilia. And I think my standards certainly haven't changed in what I want to produce, but I think I'm more forgiving in terms of mistakes now, and I understand that people are going to make mistakes, and that humans are actually cooking the food, not robots. And you have to understand, and there's so many young people in my kitchens now, and I try and think back to when I was 22 years old and I walked into a kitchen and I had never held a knife before. And I asked if someone could teach me, and I said, I'll do whatever you want. I just want to work here. And these three chefs said, yes, we'll take you in. And I really try and remember that every day when I see an 18-year-old intern in my kitchen or a 19-year-old kid, and I'm watching, and they don't quite know what they're doing, but they're trying so hard. And I think it's just an approach of talking calmly to people and teaching them instead of just imposing on them what you want.
It's putting the knife down, really.
Yeah.
Metaphorically.
Yeah, I like that, Laura. I'm going to use that tonight.
You're welcome. Next cookbook, just things you do with your hands. Anyway, last question. What has been the greatest compliment or the most memorable compliment you've received, and what's been the most memorable criticism?
Oh, wow. The most memorable, let's start with the compliments.
Always.
No one ever criticizes me, Laura. I mean, really.
Pretend that happened once.
The most memorable compliment, it's happened more than once, is when people tell me my food is better or as good as what they've just eaten in Italy. I've worked really hard to be able to bring home Italy to New York and to take all the things I've learned from traveling there and living there and just reading and researching and really try and, while I have my own style of cooking, really pay homage to their culture. So when I hear that, that's amazing. I think the toughest criticism I've probably gotten was a little review I got earlier this year. And truth be told, I had never gotten a poor review before in my career. And I'd gotten like Yelp reviews and stuff like that, but like a real...
Well, they're universally
like,
poor.
A thing that like a lot of people read and that was from a decent publication. And it was tough for me, but... And I can't remember the specifics of like what they said, but they definitely thought I missed the mark at the new restaurant. And that was really hard for me. And whether you want to believe the criticism or not believe the criticism, you have to look at yourself and you have to say like, okay, well, this person is saying you kind of suck and this person is saying you're amazing, and who are you going to believe and what are you going to do? And like, it's really easy to turn and say, okay, well, I just got 3 stars from the New York Times, so I'm good. But that's not what happened to me. I like spent weeks being like, how do I make this better? Or what did I do wrong? Or is this person right? And you do have to realize that a review is one person writing a review. It is not a group of people. It's one person's opinion, but that one person's opinion can make you feel really terrible. And I recovered from it, but it definitely made it more challenging to celebrate the amazing review that I got the exact same day within 7 minutes.
Yeah, right.
But it did make me think, and it makes me motivated, and you never want someone to not like your work, and my work is really personal. So, yeah.
That's what gets you out of bed every day.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's the brilliance of Missy about all of this is your holistic, personal, sincere, no BS approach to making everything delicious and warm and incredible. So thank you so much, Missy.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's it for today's show. If you love Missy and Laura, be sure to check out the latest issue of InStyle with Jennifer Aniston on the cover for another interview between these two powerhouse personalities. And shameless plug for myself, I wrote the cover story about Jennifer. Yes, she's as cool as you would imagine. She loves rescue animals, and she even has an actual pizza oven in her kitchen. Thank you to today's sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Schools and Emmy Cheese. Radio Cherry Bomb is a production of Cherry Bomb Media. Our show is edited, engineered, and produced by Jess Seidman. Cherry Bomb is powered by Lauren Goldstein, Audrey Payne, Kia Damone, Donna Yen, Maria Sanchez, and our publisher is Kate Miller Spencer. Our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Tra La La. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hi, this is Uno Manavong, chef and owner of Red Sticks Asian Street Food and CEO of Chef Uno Brands based here in Dallas, Texas. Do you want to know who I think is the bomb? Chef Tiffany Deary from Roots Chicken Shack and Southern Table. I'm inspired by how she honors her heritage and culture through food and motivates other women chefs with her culinary journey. She started as a line cook at IHOP when she was 15 years old. Today, she's an advocate for the James Beard Waste Not Initiatives and a speaker for food policy on Capitol Hill.